Hey, it's Kim Masters, host of The Business at KCRW. We're going to start the podcast in just a few seconds, but first I want to ask you for your support. You are listening to this podcast for free, but guess what? It's not free to produce. So if you enjoy the show, please send us some support. Send us $10 by texting KCRW to the number 20222. One more time, text KCRW to the number 20222. Thanks so much, and here's the show. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. This week on The Business, let's talk about sex.
William Masters was a scientist, first and foremost, and so he was only going to report what the science revealed. And what the science revealed was that women were incredibly robust sexual creatures at a time when that message was radical.
Our guest, Michelle Ashford, tells us how she sold Showtime on the very graphic series Masters of Sex, about the pioneering and very hands-on research by William Masters and Virginia Johnson. But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, 3 years after being fired from The Walking Dead, Frank Darabont speaks out. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my co-banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, Sony Pictures Entertainment, under pressure, as you know, this was initiated by a dissident shareholder, Daniel Loeb, who did not like the way that Sony had, A, spent lots of money, and B, had an especially terrible summer with After Earth and the Smurfs sequel and White House Down, none of which performed well. Sony Pictures has addressed this issue of spending and its business model. And what they are saying is the kind of thing that would really send a chill through the industry.
Yeah, because they're very specifically cutting back the number of movies they're going to make. Sony had been making, counting its subsidiary labels, about 23 films a year. They've graduated that down to 20, and now it's going to be closer to 18. And in 2014, where they had planned on releasing about 9 movies from all Sony labels, they're now going to release about 4. So if you're a filmmaker who wants to do business at Sony, and generally that's been a very good place to go to work, you're going to be a little less happy, a little less welcome.
Yeah, I mean, Sony has had a long standing, in some ways, they've stood out among all the studios as the most spendy, as the most extravagant. Amy Pascal, the longtime head of the studio, along with Michael Lynton, has a passionate love of movies. She is a defender and backer of filmmakers. And so she makes movies that other studios might not have been willing to make, like Moneyball, like The Social Network, like, you know, Captain Phillips. And she has thrown a lot of support. You could argue too much support behind all of these movies, because I think Sony just spends beyond any other studio in town.
Yeah, but very specifically, the studio lost $181 million in the last quarter, and that was not because of those highbrow adult dramas. It was because of their big and failed bets on movies like White House Down, on After Earth, and even on Smurfs 2. So there's a lot more that is a problem with Sony, but as you said, they're very spendy. And for Michael Lynton to say in this presentation that Sony is entering a new era of greater accountability, I guess there are a lot of people who would say that accountability should have come a long time ago.
But I think Sony's problems go beyond, you know, this culture of spending, and really also are structural. You know, it's a Japanese company owns Sony Pictures Entertainment. So unlike Fox, unlike Disney, unlike Universal even, this company cannot own cable channels, and cable channels throw off tons of money and forgive a lot of sins. It's Universal's had some pretty bouncy times, but Comcast is so gigantic, and NBC Universal has USA Network and all kinds of other properties that just make the studio business sort of shrivel in comparison. Sony can't do that.
No, and I think the other really interesting question about the future of Sony is, now on the lot is probably one of Hollywood's most, I guess, notorious cost cutters. That's Tom Rothman, who used to run 20th Century Fox with Jim Giannopoulos. He is now kind of waiting in the wings, I think, to see if he can bring his fiscal rigidity to Sony. And he has a small role at the studio now, but I guess, hypothetically, that could expand very quickly.
Yeah, it's really an interesting development. He is sort of reviving Sony's TriStar label, which hadn't been doing much of anything for a long time. But he is like the anti-Amy Pascal. Amy has great talent relationships and spends too much. Tom has not such great talent relationships and is very disciplined and has, you know, a great story to tell about the amount of profit he's squeezed out without having quite the bragging ability on the great movies, you know, the highbrow movies that Amy has. But films aside, Sony is now saying they're going to put more emphasis on television production. They do have some successful shows. They had Breaking Bad. They will have the Breaking Bad spinoff that's coming. They have The Blacklist, which is a bright spot for NBC. They do want to stress that business. They think they can make more money there.
And Sony also has the Spider-Man franchise, so they could rebound a little bit when the next Spider-Man movie comes out. Maybe do a little bit better than the producers of the Broadway musical have been doing.
Yes, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. We've talked about it before. I don't know that we're going to be talking about it again because it is closing in January. This outrageously expensive musical that almost became a punchline for the injuries and accidents that happened as they were trying to mount this ambitious thing. Julie Taymor, who had done so well with Lion King, just completely frustrated trying to get this thing to work. Music by U2. It was a debacle from the beginning, and it is going to end up losing about $60 million.
There's very few comparisons for a show that fail that spectacularly on Broadway. I mean, basically, a big flop could be a $10, maybe $15 million loss on Broadway. It was not only very expensive to start, it cost about $75 million to launch. It cost more than $1 million a week to run because of all the special effects and flying effects, and almost all the producers lost their entire investment. Now, they hope they can turn it into some sort of arena show in Las Vegas, maybe take it to Europe. Again, I don't know if that's going to succeed. And the show for a while, I think large part because people wanted to see if actors were going to fall from their flying harnesses, did incredibly well. It grossed a lot of money, but its costs were so high it could never keep up with the tickets. And once the ticket sales slowed, it was doomed.
Speaking of things that have turned out to be doomed, the relationship between Frank Darabont and AMC. Frank Darabont was the original showrunner on Walking Dead, which, as you probably know, is one of the big success stories of television, a giant hit for AMC. AMC canned Frank Darabont after he delivered this hit. They made him go to a Comic-Con a couple of years ago and hype the show and sing to the crowds that love that show. And literally within like 24 hours, they said, by the way, did we mention you are fired? And he has been very reluctant to address this up until now, but he has a new show to promote and he has a few choice words.
Yeah, his new show is called Mob City. It premieres on TNT in early December. One thing we should throw out, Frank Darabont is not just a Johnny-come-lately. He has a great body of work, especially in film with Shawshank Redemption, Green Mile, and The Mist. And he had some choice words for what he thinks about The Walking Dead now.
Well, he said he doesn't watch The Walking Dead because it would be the equivalent of if your lover left you for the Pilates instructor and sent you an invitation to the wedding. But he did, in a presentation to present Mob City, he did refer to AMC as sociopaths who don't give a about your feelings or the feelings of your cast and crew because they have their own reasons to screw everybody. AMC, startlingly, John, had no comment.
Yeah, and I guess Frank Darabont's ultimate revenge will be if Mob City becomes as big a hit as Walking Dead.
That would be sweet. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can find us on Facebook at KCRW's The Business, and you can follow us on Twitter. My handle is at Kim Masters. John's is at JG Horn, and our producer, Darby Maloney's, is at Darby KCRW. Coming up later in the show, Michelle Ashford, creator of Masters of Sex, talks about selling Showtime on a show about sex that's not really erotic. But first, how The Sopranos changed her life. The Showtime series Masters of Sex follows researchers William Masters and Virginia Johnson, whose controversial study of human sexuality led to the landmark 1966 book Human Sexual Response. For the record, William Masters was no relation to me. In the show, which has already been renewed for a second season, William Masters is played by Michael Sheen, well known for portraying Tony Blair in several films, including The Queen. Lizzie Kaplan, who's been featured in True Blood, plays Virginia Johnson. Masters was a cerebral medical doctor and well-regarded fertility expert who had begun to take a clinical interest in sex when he hired Johnson to be his secretary. She was a former lounge singer, a divorced single mother, and for the day, she had an unusually open attitude towards sexual pleasure.
Women often confuse love with physical attraction.
Sex?
Yes. Women often think that sex and love are the same thing, but they don't have to be. They don't even have to go together. Sex can be perfectly good on its own, whereas love is...
I don't think I've ever heard a woman express such an opinion.
It's not a theory I trot out at dinner parties.
Our guest, Michelle Ashford, worked as a writer on projects including the HBO miniseries The Pacific and John Adams before she created the Masters of Sex series, along with producing partner Sarah Timberman. Ashford started out on the 1980s series Cagney and Lacey, but she soon realized that working on other people's shows wasn't for her.
Because that is an incredibly time-consuming job, and I thought, if I'm going to work this hard, I really want to create my own show. So I spent many years writing pilots for networks. And then at one point,
let me just pause there. You say writing pilots. You're shooting to get your series. You're not writing something that would belong to somebody else. You're trying to
get... Yes, I'm trying to get my own show on the air. And
so are you getting these... You're getting deals to do these pilots?
Yes. So, for example, ABC will say, we'll pay you X to write a pilot. And then either I come to them with an idea or they would say, we want to do a family show set in Kansas. Can you do that? And so this can go on for a very long time. And the remarkable thing about our business is that you get paid... quite often, whether you succeed or fail, you get paid for the work. And so,
right. So we know people who have had a career where essentially nothing has ever
exactly
gotten
been
on
made.
The air.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can have movies written that are never made. You can be paid over and over and over again for something that never sees the light of day, which is a kind of fantastic thing if you're trying to make a living in this business because it's so mercurial.
Except
and
for that haunting sorrow.
Yes, exactly.
The babies that were never born.
Exactly. Well, it's, and for me as well, there was a point where I would look at this gigantic stack of unproduced pilots, and I'd think, wow, this is depressing. At some point, you do want to bring the baby into the world. But I in the year 2000, as I was in network television and very frustrated because I felt like I didn't like the notes that I got. I didn't like the restrictions.
And this is on the pilots.
These are even writing pilots, yeah.
Right.
I was just frustrated, but I wasn't sure exactly why, except for something wasn't clicking. And then that was the year, I believe, The Sopranos came on. And it completely changed my life. It changed how I perceived what television could be. And so I immediately thought, oh, that is what I want to do. I want to write that kind of television. And I could only envision that in cable, which at that point was just beginning to blossom. I mean, that The Sopranos was really the first big hit for HBO, and other cable networks were really not in this business. And so I worked very hard to work for HBO from then on.
Had you been trying to fit yourself like a round peg into square hole with these network,
I think,
broadcast network shows?
Yes, I think I was. I would come up with ideas and people would say the character needs to be more likable or the story needs to be more relatable or it needs a happier ending. And I felt myself just not fitting in with this aesthetic. And so I became very inspired. And so I tried for many years. I wrote three pilots, I believe, for HBO. And then at the same time, The Band of Brothers had aired. And I thought, oh, my God, that is also incredibly smart and interesting. And so
I
was wildly dramatic and heartbreaking. And I love the history of it as well. I thought the history was fascinating. And so as I was writing these pilots for HBO, I also said, I want to be on your next miniseries. And that ended up being John Adams. And I wrote actually a bigger part of John Adams at the beginning. Then the whole series got cut down. I ended up with a very small slice of that. But the experience was still fantastic. And then I ended up working on The Pacific. Yet I was having a hard time getting these pilots on HBO.
Was Masters of Sex a pitch to HBO and a no thank you?
Well, once my producing partner and I decided we were going to do this and we're definitely going to turn this into a series, we did talk to HBO. And I think at the time the response was, and a lot of people have made this comment about Masters of Johnson, which is, wasn't there a movie about them that was kind of...
And what there was all, the movie? I can remember there was a movie.
Yeah, well, it's very funny. The movie was about Kinsey. It wasn't about Masters, but everybody thinks it's the same.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
I know, no, everyone thinks this. And everyone says, no, but there was that movie. And we keep saying, no, that wasn't about Masters and Johnson. That was about Kinsey. And it was 10 years earlier, and it's actually a very different story. But I think HBO just couldn't see it as a series. Then we took it to FX. And we're both very friendly with John Landgraf. And he loved it. But he said, I have advertisers. And I don't see any prayer of getting this show on FX because we simply won't be able to handle the nudity. The nudity is just going to be a non-starter. And in the meantime, we both have known David Nevins for many years. Sarah, the head of Showtime. Sarah Timmerman, my partner, has known him for many years. I have also known him. And she saw him at an airport and said, you know what? Read this book. And he read it immediately and he loved it and got it. And it's been a very, very happy marriage, actually.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Michelle Ashford, who created the Showtime series Masters of Sex, based on the book of the same name. Written by Tom Mayer, the book was informed by many interviews with people who knew or worked with the researchers, and with Virginia Johnson, who died earlier this year.
Tom Mayer spent many, 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 many hours talking to Virginia Johnson. So he had her full cooperation. And what was so extraordinary about it is this is really the first time she had talked about the truth of their personal relationship, which was, I think, a very thorny subject for her because I think she had unresolved feelings about it. So it's very interesting when you read the book, you get a sense of a woman trying to have a sense of her posterity. Like, how is she going to be perceived? She was giving these interviews in her 80s. So it's a very curious puzzle for us because we don't know sometimes some of the quotes from Tom's book, if that's really what she felt or if that's how she wanted to be represented. And so we spent a lot of time really thinking about her psychology.
From a journalism, as a person trying to research something, it's a little frustrating to have one perspective,
yes,
I would think.
Yes, it is. Now, Tom did go and ask, interview many, many people in their world.
But who could know the inner secrets?
Exactly, but who could know the truth of those two, except for those two? And even then, what they would say about their relationship is maybe filtered through all sorts of curious emotions.
And yes, who knows?
Who knows?
Did you ask for her blessing?
We did, and we were so anxious to meet her. We really tried, and she had absolutely no interest at all. And I think...
Did you say, we're doing this thing, and it's real, and you're going to be played by this person?
Yes, and in fact, even sadder thing was that Lizzie Kaplan, who ended up being the actress playing Virginia Johnson, was desperate to meet her. We just wanted to shower her with love and gratitude and thank you, and just wanted to see her and talk. And no, and Lizzie wrote her letters, and we just couldn't make any headway at all.
Did she state a reason?
Tom Mayer wrote the book. I think his idea is probably the truest one, which is that she really bared her soul for his book. And I think she felt like, I'm in my 80s. I'm done. I'm done talking about this.
I mean, one of the extraordinary things about Virginia Johnson was how sexually free she was at a point where, sex was just completely not discussed. And it was like the Dick Van Dyke Show era with the twin
beds
and all of that.
By the way, Masters did, in fact, sleep in twin beds with his wife, which is such a curious fact. We thought, God, if we made this up, no one would believe it. So we're very glad that it was true.
I mean, did it appeal to you in part as a feminist story?
Well, it's very interesting, that question, because while I love the fact that it ended up having a sort of unintentional feminism kind of message, a feminist message there, I think they were accidental feminists. And I think as a result, we're sort of doing an accidentally feminist show. It wouldn't be my intent to say, I see this as an opportunity to really make a strong feminist statement. That is really wouldn't be interesting to me just in and of itself. But what I do really love, and I love this about them, and I think as a result, we're sort of doing the same thing. William Masters was a scientist, first and foremost. And so he was only going to report what the science revealed. And what the science revealed was that women were incredibly robust sexual creatures at a time when that message was radical. And so because he was standing by his science no matter what, he became this incredible champion of women. But it wasn't a political thing.
It was a science thing.
Mm-hmm. And so I love that. And I think as a result, because we're telling this story, it does end up being sort of a feminist statement, I think.
Coming up after a short break, how Michael Sheen reacted to the idea of getting very physical in Masters of Sex.
Hi, this is Darby Maloney, producer of The Business. Catch up with The Business and lots of film and television news on our Facebook page. Search for KCRW's The Business and click like.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with Michelle Ashford. She's the creator and showrunner of the Showtime series Masters of Sex, about the trailblazing sex researchers William Masters and Virginia Johnson.
I'm wiring Mr. Mello to monitor pulse, heart rate, and brain waves to illuminate to my patients and to the general community what happens to the body during sexual stimulation and orgasm. The magazines are to help with the stimulation part because, unbeknownst to me, Mr. Mello prefers women, which, to be frank, concerns me because it may, in fact, throw off my data.
Why would it throw off your data? Isn't an orgasm an orgasm?
Early in her career, Michelle Ashford tried for a good decade to get a show of her own on broadcast TV before she moved her focus to cable. After working on The Pacific and John Adams for HBO, Ashford finally scored with Masters of Sex, her first pilot that was picked up to series. Ashford says Showtime gave her and producing partner Sarah Timberman a lot of freedom in dealing with the very graphic, but not always erotic, sex scenes in the show.
They were incredibly respectful of show the sex how you want to show it. Show it how it's honest to the show and honest to this story. And they've completely stood behind us in that regard. And it's been great.
And I'm just curious, the talent, you obviously, I don't know how much of it had been written as the talent came on. What did you have to show them in terms of script? The two leads.
Yeah. Coarsest way, she basically has to get naked in that pilot. So she read that script and knew immediately that this is going to be, you know, a huge part of this job. And how did she feel about it? We did know about Lizzie that she had, and this is not in any way why we cast her, but that she was actually comfortable with that. She had been on True Blood, and that had been part of the role that she was playing in that. So we knew she wasn't skittish about nudity, which was actually important, because what we didn't want to deal with is an actress that was deeply uncomfortable with it, so we were always trying to work around it. On the other hand, it wasn't the idea of oh, now we have our lead actress, let's show her topless as many times as we can. That was not at all what we were interested in.
Right.
So she knew right off the bat, because it's in the pilot. Michael was a different thing because
he gets to keep his clothes on in the pilot.
He gets to keep his clothes on, but we did say that's not going to last. How do you feel about it? And Michael's fearless, and he said, I'm fine. I'll do it.
I mean, the way the sex is portrayed, it's not romantic. It's almost undignified.
Well, I'm going to say thank you. That's kind of the idea. What we didn't want was the stereotypical sex scenes to be sexy, and I guess we've succeeded.
I think so. Let me ask you about, as a woman, when you had that pile of pilots that were not going anywhere, did you feel that TV was tilted towards men? I mean, I know you worked early on you'd written an episode of Cagney and Lacey, mm-hmm. which was two female showrunners, Barbara Avedon and Barbara Corday. I don't know if that seemed unusual then to have these two women.
Oh, I was probably I wasn't really aware of it then because I actually started as an assistant on that show. And so that was how I was able to get that first job. But I'm sure it was very radical then. And I will say,
There was a Marcy Carsey out there, and there was
a
Linda
couple,
Bloodworth,
yes,
Thomason.
In, it wasn't in Half
of.
Hour, there were a few, and Diane
English.
Yeah, English.
Murphy Brown.
Right, exactly. So there was no, and I think more in the Half Hour world that existed, I think less so. But look, there have been women who have run shows, definitely. But they're definitely in the minority. And it has not been my experience that I have been held back in any way for being a woman. Now, I could just be unaware, perhaps, of decisions that were made, but I don't think so. I think that people in Hollywood are so desperate for good material, they'll take it from anything or anyone if it's really good. And so I didn't feel ever that I was held back for being a woman. I really didn't. And I had many jobs like The Pacific and John Adams, and I was on staffs of shows where I was the only woman. And it seemed to be completely fine. So I didn't feel that it was that these pilots weren't getting made because I was at a disadvantage because of my sex. It is curious, though, that this, which is really by far the one that has landed and taken root, is about feminism in an odd way, and women coming to terms with their sexuality. So it is curious when people comment a lot that, oh my gosh, you're a woman, your partner's a woman, you've hired a lot of women directors, you have women writers, and what a curious thing you're creating here. And I would just say, gosh, it was almost, the whole thing was accidental, the fact that this seems to be so female-centric in many ways.
And what do you, you know, the disparity, the Writers Guild is always, there are various sources of reports about the extreme minority of women in these jobs behind the camera, you know, it's just pretty drastic, and it's been pretty static. There's been very little actual progress.
Yes,
so
I've read all this.
So why would that, is the cause?
It's about?
Yeah.
Well, God, it's really hard to say, except for that if most of these jobs are men are in charge, I would just say that they're probably not making an effort maybe to find women. They're just going to find, when you're, I think the weird thing about running a show is when you're doing this job, all you're looking for are people you know of, friends of friends who say this is a fabulous writer. And if you're just, I don't know, I can only say, I guess if you're just in a sort of a boys club to begin with, you're just not going to make the effort, I would just say, to find the great female writer. You're just going to do what is expedient and going to make your show work. You're not looking at it as like, oh, I should really be diverse. I should be really exploring women.
I assume you're including yourself.
I would say, oddly, you're just trying to get through. And I would say that is true for me. We did end up with a fair amount of women, but that was just based on the material.
Do you have a rough, it's 50-50, 60-40?
Yeah. No, I would say, well, with our writing staff, we have 4 women and 2 men. We did have 2 women directors. I think directing is even harder, to be honest. I think there's probably more women writing than there are women directing. That seems to be a much more typically male job. It's just worked out how it has, but I'm thrilled, actually.
I mean, does it? Some women that we talk to, I mean, there's certain women in power. They don't want to be. Some of them are more into the, like, yes, I want women to advance, and some of them feel like they don't even want to be seen in that through that lens. They
yes.
just want to be judged on their own merit and not male or female.
Yes.
I don't know if you feel...
I do. I would not particularly want to be singled out as, oh, she's a good female writer. She's a good female showrunner. It's like, you're either good or you're not good. I actually have no interest in that either, because it's... I think when you're actually doing these jobs, you care so much about the work. And if the work isn't speaking for itself, it doesn't really matter who the gender of the person behind the work. You just want the work, people to say the work is fantastic or it's not. And so to qualify it with your gender just seems like knocking it down a notch for no reason.
Right. Michelle Ashford is the creator and showrunner on the Showtime series Masters of Sex. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Melissa Morton. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, TuneIn, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.